like trees. Men, people walking like trees. What an interesting. Again, every week we look at Jesus and his interactions with some people, and it's surprising, it's a little odd. Not everything exactly makes obvious sense. I love this about the Bible, and I love this about Jesus. He's not exactly predictable in the way that he acts and what he does. And so what I'd like us to do is we're going to dig into this a little bit, and to begin, I'm going to ask you to do a bit of work, since I've done some work for this, so you can do some work as well. So what I'd like us to do for the next few minutes is turn to the person next to you or group up with a couple of people and look at the parallels, look for the parallels between the first story and the second story. So the parallels between the healing of the blind man and the parallels between that and Peter declaring that Jesus is the Messiah. Have a look at those two incidents.
Got one?
A parallel, yes?
I think the first one that we notice is that in the first story, there's a point of clarity. And thought there were trees that are upside down. Then he saw clearly, then he realized that there are human beings. And in the second story, you have a similar thing happening. Peter realizes you are the Messiah. Mm-hmm. So there's clarity, even in the second story. Clarification, you are the Messiah.
Clarification in both incidents. Yeah, Bill.
Both at the end of both bits, it's almost the same thing. Don't even go into the village.
Mm.
And don't tell anybody about it.
Okay. Don't go, don't tell.
Yeah.
All right, a warning. Okay, what else? What else do we see? Parallels. Aya?
Just the fact that Christ, Jesus, had to ask them specific questions. It was more Jesus trying to help them to faith. He asked the disciples, who do people say I am? He asked the man, what do you see? It's wanting people to think not just what people say, but what they have said, what has been revealed to them.
Okay. So we got Jesus asking a question in both of those stories. And that's surprising in that culture.
Yeah.
So firstly, it's the only time in the whole of the Gospels that Jesus ever asks someone about their healing. Wow. Doesn't ask them any other time. Mm-hmm. And with the disciples, rabbis never asked their disciples questions. Mm-hmm. The disciples asked their rabbis questions. And then the rabbi would teach. So this is a reversal of what we normally see. So the interesting fact. Okay, any other parallels?
He would be the case when it's done to the crowd. In both situations, he could be in the outside village.
Yeah.
He wouldn't go back to his own protection. We talked about that. About why not go and talk about it? Why, we suddenly think the city would be finding ways to be against the man, things like that.
Very possibly.
But with the apostles.
Yeah.
They got the word and gave life. They can use a blasphemy. So he's protecting them, and he's not going for the crowd.
Yes, not for show. And as a protection to them, and I think also for the focus of his ministry, because he needed to get to Jerusalem eventually and not be stopped on the way. So both situations we have taking away to somewhere private, I suppose. Okay, anything else? Any other parallels between these two? Yeah?
So they both have their eyes open.
Mm-hmm.
One spiritually, one physically.
Mm-hmm. There's an opening, and you could add to that there's two stages for both in a way. A man has his eyes partially healed and fully, and then the disciples get the answer sort of right, part right. Mm-hmm. John the Baptist, Elijah, a prophet, and then Peter comes up with the complete answer, Messiah. So there are two stages of insight, or you could say. Okay, I think those are the main parallels, unless you've seen some I haven't. You may well. Any others? What's that?
Decapolis.
Decapolis?
Declaration. Not the time to declare.
Not the time to declare. Okay, so we've got so both situations. There's a bit like what you were saying, Barry. There's a time to spread the word, and there's a time to withhold. Okay.
I think, yeah, go ahead.
There's also, Bay Jesus has to, just mention it, Bay Jesus does the action twice with the blind man. My belief is that, as we all know, that Christ wouldn't have necessarily needed to do the action twice to heal the person. So, but there's
the
bit in between why he's doing that. There's a reason he's doing that.
Mm-hmm.
He could have healed him for a part, just for once. He goes out his way to do the action twice, but then the opportunities in between is the question.
But isn't that an amazing thing? You're right. So, okay, I'll tell you what, let's stop on that thought for a moment. Let's stay with that thought for a minute. Because I think we need to ask ourselves, why would Jesus do this? Given that he was perfectly capable of healing from afar or with one touch, or, I mean, you know, he had all the powers at his disposal. So why only deliberately, and I think we have to assume this, it's not stated in the text, but I think it's a reasonable assumption, he deliberately partially healed a blind man. Why would you do that? Why would you do it? Why might Jesus do that? Any thoughts?
Well, sometimes the secret's really working. Sometimes that's at your heart and a mechanic, isn't it? And you see this and that. The part's still the same, so... Maybe you're asking to see what the response was going to be. The guy going to be like, oh, I'm not healed, I still can't see. Or, yeah.
Could be. Could be looking for the reaction of the blind man. Okay?
Yeah, maybe you are testing.
Testing the blind man? Mm-hmm.
If I knew the first time, we see talking.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to know if he would tell the truth.
Would he tell the truth? What would his attitude be? Okay, could be that, yeah, Jim.
I think Jesus did it to tell me that healing sometimes takes time.
Mm. And takes time?
In healing.
Okay, well, indeed it can. Any other thoughts?
He was also capable of showing his disciples exactly what he couldn't do.
Mm.
And he showed them how I can partially heal,
mm-hmm.
how I can heal the whole thing.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. They must have thought,
Peter. Yeah, yeah, we're going to get to Peter in a minute, which is fascinating. Akin?
I don't know. The one's passion, so the guy comes passionately to see that. I don't know if I was trying to make a point about things that we see passionately, but also if we take another step, we see clearly. Because the guy, you know, he asked the guy, do you see anything? And the guy said, yeah, he can see something, but it's not quite clear. And then he builds it, then it's really clear. Then it goes on to the other passage. I don't know if there's a point he's trying to make there about them to see things partially and then they'll see them fully when they're properly, you know.
Mm. Seems to be something along those lines, sir.
He's a rabbi, he's teaching. I think sometimes Jesus needs to put a point across not just the person who's experiencing it, but those around as well.
Mm.
And to sort of, I think sometimes we expect things to happen immediately, and it's kind of like sometimes it's not immediate, sometimes it's partial, and then it's completed, you know, and I think that's part of it. You know.
Mm.
And also to help them, I mean, later on with Peter, when he's saying, you know, what do people think? What do people think I am? And then he asks them, so what do you think? Who do you think? And it's kind of like, you know, we can often be sort of take our opinions from other people, and it's almost like, what do you think?
Mm.
And it's all, and I think, you know, sometimes that's what Jesus is trying to teach us, how we know how to know.
Yeah.
Your faith is what's important here.
Yeah. I'm going to suggest, I think that's a very helpful point, I'm going to suggest, and I'm suggesting this as my interpretation, okay, so I could well be wrong because it's not explicit in the text, but knowing and seeing the way that Jesus is around his disciples and how he is fundamentally, in his interactions with them, he is a rabbi, a teacher, like you say. I can only surmise that he's done this partial healing as a really creative teaching tool. Some teachers are really creative in the way that they teach things and help you to understand things. I think he's being here a very creative teacher and very precise. It's amazing to see that he's not just that he knows, okay, storm, calm, wind, stop, dead, raised. It's, blind man, I'm going to heal him to the precise point, the very precise point, and who knows exactly how this was done in this man's eyes, but to the precise point where he can see people that look as if trees could walk, that's how people would walk if they were trees. I'm going to get to that exact point and healing to that point. I mean, that is a very precise kind of miracle and teaching method. And then I'm going to ask him, and he's going to say, well, I can see people looking like trees walking around, and I'm going to finish it off. And then the disciples and I are going to go off to this other place and have a chat. And I'm hoping that this is going to help them to understand what's going on here. They're going to come to a better insight. And it seems to me, I don't think Jesus is playing with the man. I mean, he's going to heal him, and it's all going to be good. But he's using the opportunity in some way to help his disciples ultimately to fully understand, or at least not quite fully yet, but more fully understand what's going on.
Maybe the first time he healed the glaucoma and the second time the cataract. A great question. Why did he take the man outside the village? And why did he tell him not to go to the village, go back to him?
Okay, so I'll give a short answer because we're going to finish earlier today. Normally I'd ask the group for the wisdom because there's plenty here, but I would suggest that it's partly to make sure that it's not a show. I think somebody mentioned this. It's not a show. The people bring the blind man to Jesus and they ask him, they beg him, in fact, to heal him, which is lovely and shows their compassion for him. Jesus wants to heal him, but he doesn't want to make it a show. So I think he takes it outside the village. Also because he's not staying here. He's moving on. He's ultimately moving on to Jerusalem. And we're going to see here in chapter 8, this is a hinge point in the Gospel of Mark where Jesus has been focusing primarily on doing miracles and teaching, and particularly in the north of the country. And now we're going to hear more and more about the cross and the costs and the suffering as he begins to move towards Jerusalem to the cross. So he doesn't want things to get in the way. Same thing with the disciples. He pulls them away so that he can just teach them and deal with them, and then they can move on together to ultimately the cross. So I think that's at least part of what's going on. Maybe not all of it, but something along those lines.
Where we go. African version of the story. Probably the girl of witches in the
village. Hey, I don't know about Bethsaida in the first century, but maybe. And maybe. It's entirely possible. There's all kinds of strange things going on around Jesus, that's for sure. And so let me make a few comments and thoughts for us in terms of applying it to our own situation. It's really important, by the way, that as we do our own personal Bible study, we do try and get into the story and not just look at it on the surface level, right? And it's too easy to do that, and it doesn't sustain us spiritually. It'll do when you're in children's ministry or in a teen class, maybe. I don't know, even our teens are pretty deep, so maybe not enough for you. But as we grow as Christians, we've got to get into that text and then think, okay, what might be the application for us today? And so a few thoughts. We do have here a hinge, like I was mentioning earlier. We've got this, we're in Mark 8. It's almost exactly halfway through the gospel, and we're sort of halfway through the story in a way. And from this point on, there's a lot more talk about persecution and opposition, and the cross is looming. And when you read what Jesus is talking about and his teaching, you'll see the cross and suffering mentioned more and more and more as we get into the second half of Mark's gospel. So we're having this hinge point here. We see this second touch, I think, is deliberate. And then we see Peter having that sort of second touch where the other disciples say, maybe John the Baptist, Elijah, one of the prophets, who do you say I am? And Peter says, Messiah. So he's saying, okay, you might be a prophet type, you might be an Elijah type, but ultimately you are the king. And that's a whole different level. That's a whole different category. Messiah, essentially, to the Jewish mind in that day, meant king. You are the king, and we are with you. So I suppose maybe they're princes, maybe, or something. I don't know quite how they were thinking of themselves. But they believe, or Peter sees this, sees him as the king. And then, just have a look at verses 31 to 33, which follow this, which we haven't read yet, but we need to set it in this context. Just after the end of that story, he then began to teach them in verse 31 that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, chief priests, teachers of the law. He must be killed, and then 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and what does Peter do? Having just said, you are the Messiah, you are the king, he took him aside, another taking aside, and rebukes him. He rebukes Jesus. Now, that takes some guts, shall we say. Jesus turned and looked at his disciples. He rebuked Peter. So, okay, he gets it back. Get behind me, Satan, he said. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. And so we have a blind man, partially sighted, then fully sighted. We have disciples that partially see, and Peter then kind of fully sees Messiah, king, but he still hasn't really fully seen what Jesus is all about. So Peter is wrestling, and this is what I think applies to me and probably to all of us here today. Peter has an ongoing wrestling with really understanding the identity of Jesus and his purpose. His identity and ultimately, you could say, his activity or his destiny. His destiny was different to the destiny that Jesus wanted his Messiah to have. And Jesus said, no, that's not the right kind of Messiah. I'm not that kind of Messiah. I'm not just a miracle worker. I'm not just a prophet. But I'm not just the kind of king that you want me to be. And of course, in that day, the Jews wanted the Messiah or expected the Messiah to come back and do 3 things. Firstly, to rebuild and cleanse the temple. That was the first big thing. Rebuild the temple or cleanse it, make it all that it's meant to be. Secondly, to defeat the enemies of Israel. Kick out whoever the enemies are, whether it's Greeks, Romans, in their history, whatever, kick them out. And thirdly, to bring God's justice and healing to Israel and through Israel to the world. And then Israel would take its deserved place in history and everything. And that was their idea. And Jesus said, no, I'm coming to die on a cross. And that just blew their minds. They were blinded to what that meant. And I think it's the parallel, at least I think for us, is to be sure that we're continually discovering the full and true identity of Jesus and his purpose in this world, his purpose in a community of faith like this, and in our own lives. What's he trying to do? The question is not, do I believe Jesus is the Son of God? I hope we do, and maybe if we don't, then we can talk about that. But maybe we've got an understanding of that level, or he went to the cross for me, or he died on the cross for sins. But what does that actually mean? What does it mean for my life, the way I live? What does it mean to be a disciple of a king who goes to a cross? See, later on, in verse 34, he tells them this, and we'll just finish with this here. Before we take bread and wine, I think it really fits with communion here. He called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves. Take up their cross, follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. And then let's do that first verse of chapter 9. And he said to them, so this fits with what he's just said, truly I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see that the kingdom of God has come with power. So Jesus is saying, yes, I'm the king and I'm going to the cross. You're my followers. So you're going to the equivalent of your cross too. Take up your cross. You're coming with me on a path of suffering. Now, this is not a very popular teaching. And, governments, if we go to the political sphere, don't tend to tell those who vote for them the truth a lot of the time, as in what things will cost. Yes, we promise you X number of new policemen, nurses, school pupil places, transport things and this, that and the other. How much will it cost? Well, several billions. Who's going to pay for that? Well, just trust us on that. We'll get it done. And they don't like to talk about the cost, the real cost to you and I, and frankly, to your generation, Mulligan and Kaiser. I mean, you guys are going to be paying for all this, I think. I'm really sorry about this, but I just think that's the way it is. And but the true cost, Jesus lays it out. He doesn't say, oh, it's all going to be little dancing lambs and fun, you know, butterflies and eating McDonald's milkshakes and everything's going to be nice. He's saying, look, if you're following me, there is a cost. Now, the cost is set in the context of the coming of the kingdom of God. So it's not a hopeless suffering. It's a purposeful suffering. His suffering brings in the kingdom. The justice of God, not as envisaged by traditional Judaism of the time, but the justice of God that we then live differently, treat people as Christ does, with that respect and dignity to all people. As we try to bring healing in people, for people where they need that healing, we pray with them, we talk, we listen, we spend time with people that others wouldn't spend time with. As we do that with each other, frankly, to create that healing community amongst ourselves, listening, spending time together, not just seeing each other on a Sunday, but communicating, talking, meeting up, and spending their time, which frankly sometimes causes suffering. I mean, it may not be the suffering of the cross exactly, but expending our time and energy for one another is costly, isn't it? It means we take time away from things that are more directly pleasurable, shall we say. And that's the calling, because the kingdom is coming, has come, and is glorious. A little bit of shame, a little bit of discomfort in this life is well worth the glory and the honor that will be ours along with Jesus. At the end of this time. So, I think we're a lot like, I'm a lot like, and perhaps we're a lot like the disciples who see Jesus, kind of know who he is, but sometimes don't embrace all of who he is. So my question for us, I'll leave you with this for today, is what is it in the way that you are living or the way you're thinking about these things? What is it that will help you to be sure that you're growing in your understanding of Jesus? That you're understanding him better, his identity and his activity or his destiny, and what that means for you. What helps you? That's one of the reasons I've gone back to London School of Theology to study this Master's in Theological Studies. Partly it's to do with a number of reasons, but part of the reason is it makes me think differently about Jesus. I'm around people who think differently about Jesus. I'm around people who read different books to me about Jesus and about the kingdom. I'm listening to people who have different experiences of Jesus to me. And that's healthy. And so that's part of my solution to growing to understand Jesus better. You don't have to do what I'm doing, but I think we all should have our own self-motivated plan. How am I going to get to know Jesus better? His identity, his activity, his destiny, and what that means for me.